This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Thank you, Richard. I'm not sure whether I should be happy or not with the placement or timing. I mean, I'm afraid that I have more accessible stuff to talk about. Brian had been to a talk I did about this, and I had read something he had written. So if you get tired of cesspool, I would try to sort of limit the cesspool conversation and move the conversation to anonymity itself and how it works in a variety of media. But the paper is outside if you care to read the paper. And so I will try to concentrate on the parts that you haven't heard about yet. And also, just to foresee some questions afterwards, I am also loose with the First Amendment, but unlike Brian, I'm perfectly proud to be loose with the so-called doctrine. I mean, there aren't that many people anymore who would say how proud they were of hundreds of years of this doctrinal history. So yeah, that would be fine with me if we can be fast and loose with the categories, and I'll just let you know, signal you that I'll be happy to be loose with them. So the paper is called The Internet's Anonymity Problem. Of course, the Internet doesn't have an anonymity problem. Anonymity is not a problem. It's just one possible remedy to other problems. But I'll think of it as an anonymity problem anyway and describe two different problems and talk about them. The real problem is twofold. One we've heard a lot about, and the other one that I guess I will choose to focus on today. One problem is the harm that comes from offensive communications. Leaving aside the benefits of offensive communications, which I will turn to at some length, there is the problem of people who are injured. I'm largely interested in juvenile communications as well, but I'm also interested in commercial information. In the paper, I go back and forth between two kinds of examples, one represented by juicycampus.com, a site that I think probably people in this room don't visit very often, but in other rooms, everyone visits all the time. And then I picked one of many commercial sites, although I refer to Amazon.com and CNET and sites like that. I also focus a little bit on more of a negative Angie's List kind of site, and the one that I use for my example is called ripoffreports.com, in case anybody has been there or maybe been maligned on it or whatever. So I'll describe those, and we can keep those examples in mind, that there are many kinds of offense, and I want to think of that as a problem. And another part of the problem is not just offensive information, but something we really haven't talked about yet today, noise, or noisy information. That is, the more you allow on, or the less certain kinds of barriers are, both commercial and legal, then the more stuff there is out there. And again, I'm going to spend a lot of my energy on that. You know, if you have a wall and the wall is available to everybody and everybody can come put graffiti on it or whatever more positive word you want to give that, there might be a lot of valuable information on the wall, but there might also be a lot of junk on the wall. And almost everybody who wants the valuable information, that is both, you know, free speech believers and people who like calling somebody a slut, I mean, whatever it is that your goal is to get your message out there, the idea that there's a lot of noise out there and a lot of people just pass by the wall and don't give a hoot what's on it, I mean, I think of that as also a cost, because it's a cost to almost all users in a way that I will carefully define by referring to a sort of traditional hypothetical bargain. So, and then at the end, I'll try to tie it back to constitutional thinking. So that's where I'm going. But one other thing I want to say by way of introduction, so as not to say it each step on the way, especially this morning, there's a lot of discussion, or it's common almost by having a conference like this, that as soon as you put internet in the title, then everybody thinks, whoa, internet's so different. Facebook, there's never been anything like it. I mean, everything's novelty. And, I'm old, and therefore, it's my job to be sort of anti-novelty. Because I think that is the story of law, right? Law is about, you want to change the rule, you're a legislator, or an academic, or a student, or whatever it is. I mean, you, or an interest group, you want a new rule, it's to your interest, it's your advantage to describe something as novel. Never been seen before, first time, step right up. And then if I don't want to change the rule, or I like a rule that already exists for some other industry, it's to my advantage to say, oh no, this is really exactly like the problem we've seen before, precedent's so important, stability, 200 years of First Amendment doctrine, you know, whatever it is that you want to say, to show that, you know, in some, and you get the idea, right? Novelty is is ubiquitous. The question is when we should take novelty to be worth something different and when not. And the paper, you know, introduces itself by that way, though I don't really stick to it as a long theme. But I want to signal that at the outset. Every time I hear a claim of novelty or precedent, I'm wary of interest groups and how the political process is working and thinking of those earlier terms as rhetoric. So maybe a place to start, and where, certainly where I do in the paper, is by saying, you know, it's really important to see that the internet, whether or not you think it's really novel, it's treated as if it's novel. It's different. Every speaker has mentioned Section 230 so far, so therefore I guess I better mention it as well. That's one source, maybe the most important source of difference. The way I would think about it is I would say line up however many media you want. I mean, I'll offer four or five or six of them. Think about all the ways in which you can deliver offensive and non-offensive messages. Then ask where the internet fits in that portfolio, and then try to think, well, does the internet deserve, in a sense, more regulation or less regulation by the government than these other media? And I think you can make a variety of cases. These are apples and oranges to some degree. So I, in the paper, talk about television radio. Again, the argument's there. We can all see them. Oh, it's a scarce resource, therefore more regulation. Oh, that's a high barrier to entry, therefore that. I mean, there are a lot of arguments associated with it as a medium that stands alone. Then I spent a lot of time, which I'll do in a moment, on thinking about the internet as the evolutionary successor of the bathroom wall. And you know, it's interesting to think what the law is of this wall. Again, in some sense, the wall is easy to write on, in some sense not. I'm going to give some examples in a minute. There's also the newspaper out there, and then maybe the more conventional soapbox. So I want to sort of think about all those media together, and then note, if I am an offensive, sort of juvenile or commercially offensive speaker, I like the internet better than those other media in modern times. It gives me more power. And yet it's also undeniable that the internet is the least regulated. I have the greatest freedom there, and the person who controls the internet site gets off much easier in law than the owner of the bathroom wall or the newspaper publisher or the television frequency controller or even the guy in the soapbox. And that's what seems to me the mismatch, and then I'm going to firm that up and take off from there. So, Juicy Cam, let's just go over the first offense, though you've heard probably more about it than you want. I was worried, actually, that this conference would consist of everybody giving their favorite examples of offense. I can't match, jeez. You know, but I became a Juicy Campus aficionado. And there is a person on Juicy Campus who I've renamed in the paper. Because the treatment of her is really awful, so I'll just call her Amy X. So you think about juvenile communications on one of these, it's not even a social network site. There's nothing on Juicy Campus anymore. There used to be some valuable information. It's organized by campus sites, so you type in Princeton, and then it gives you all these searches related to Princeton, and then you can type in Bill Smithfield, professor of anthropology at Princeton, and you'll get all the gossip about Bill Smithfield. Once upon a time, it had a little bit of information about Smithfield. He rocks. His exam, he likes surprise quizzes. That's all gone. Now it's, you know, there's almost nothing about Bill Smithfield, but if there is, it's about his anatomy or, you know, how he defecates or something. But there's a lot of information about classmates. It's all devolved essentially to calling Amy X a slut, the example I use in the paper. It'll usually begin with someone throwing out questions, you know, who's the sluttiest girl on campus? What's the most evil sorority on campus? You know, which fraternity does the most, you know, bestial behavior? And then usually there'll be no takers. It just moves on and on. But then every once in a while, exactly as described, somebody will be in there responding, and once you get one or two responses, there's this piling on phenomenon. It becomes sort of fun, I guess, for some people. And a lot of people go on there taunting, and they build up the whole case against, you know, Jane Doe or Amy X or whatever it is. And it gets vicious, and if you're Amy X, you're really hurt, and we should talk about the costs and benefits of the various players in that, as it were. So that, I want to think of that as one offense. The harm to Amy X, which we've talked about before, so I won't go back to. In that sense, that's the sense in which I mean that the internet is the successor to the bathroom wall. Say a few things about that while we're on it. I've tried to do some empirical evidence about this around High Park. by asking people who are in control of these walls and the bathroom. So, for example, University Facilities reports, I had a nice conversation with them just yesterday, the amount of graffiti on bathroom walls is tiny compared to what it was 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, you would write, Amy, you might write, I didn't, Amy X is a slut on the wall. And, you know, you'd have some things about teachers and some things about this and pictures of genitalia and then some, a little bit of political speech here and there. No, bathroom wall is really inconvenient. You know, you got a magic marker or scratch it in there. Very, very rare are there long messages on the wall. Once in a while, there'd be a limerick. And, you know, it would occur after many visits to the stall or something. But mostly, it's kind of the worst kind of speech, if you like, useful. I mean, every once in a while, there's really clever, you know, witty political speech, bumper sticker kind of speech. But mostly, you know, we like messages, you know, real messages. The juvenile behavior on Juicy Canvas is a lot like the bathroom wall. It's not ideal. Indeed, it's a little bit odd to understand how the juveniles can be so juvenile. You know, Amy X's slot seems sort of useless to me. It's so juvenile as to be useless. There are many possible responses. You wonder why Amy X and her friends, seeing that, don't just immediately write, oh, you know, Abby's a slut, Martha's a slut, Bill's a slut, Ralph's mother's a slut. You know, 1,000 slut names all over the site, you know, being called a slut wouldn't really be worth it. I mean, there are a lot of ways you can confuse speech, just as you can on the Medici tavern table or something, if you go read that. So there is, you know, there are clever juvenilisms. Amy X is a slut and gave me the following sexually transmitted disease. That sounds just slightly more specific. There's one that I got off a local old tavern table that they had saved for posterity that really was painful to me. I wish I could go. I will get the exact words wrong, but it's something like Amy X did a dog behind Bartlett Hall. This was held up as the entrepreneur as a really stunning example. Everybody went to look at that. Wow, that seemed really detailed. And there's something about the detail that makes it seem like, whoa, you know, maybe there's something to it. And, you know, again, but it's interesting how rare those things are. Juicy Canvas is exactly like that. It has very, you could sit and type along things, but they're generally really short. Nevertheless, there's a lot of piling on. And by the time the 15th person gets there, it gets much, much more clever and longer. And there is a lot of that. If you think about it that way, then you see the internet's an outlier. Bathroom walls got real law to it. I mean, it's vandalism. You can get caught. A waiter can catch you scratching on a table. And besides, the bathroom wall gets cleaned. Cleaned and cleansed both, you know, in a sense. You got to write quick messages on the bathroom wall and get out of there as fast as possible. You don't have to do that on the internet. There, obviously, once identified, there's some chance of a defamation claim, though probably not from writing these short things. Again, to go back to the, it has to be factually wrong, and maybe people are good about that. But, you know, you might, even just a claim of defamation against you might be sort of annoying. But the vandalism claim is there for sure if you do it in the university bathroom. When I visited Harvard Law School, there was actually someone thrown out for regular graffitiing, as the student newspaper pointed out, on the faculty bathroom. That's what was really bad about it. I, to that point, had never known that there was such a thing as a student bathroom and a faculty bathroom, but I had just, I guess, insufficient experience with hierarchy. Let's move on because we've had enough cesspool talk for the day. The second kind of cost is, I think, the more obvious law and economics one, which is that if you think about the advantage of the internet as a medium of low access cost, anybody can start a blog, and indeed anybody does, as we saw from that curve earlier, that seems to be a really good thing about the medium. But that's not such a good thing if it turns out that to have a useful medium, either because law steps in and puts requirements on you, or just because noise is uninteresting to readers, it's not a good thing if law or social convention raises the real cost of running that medium. So the medium's easy to set up, but if it's full of Amy X is a slut on it, and no one wants to read anything else, and I have to be on it, like Brian, deleting things, going through comments, erasing, keeping some things on, some things off, then it's it's sort of lost its major advantage of having been this cheap medium. And whatever your feelings about the novelty, it's less novel, much more like newspapers, which of course evolved, as is well known, towards only accepting letters to the editor where they could trace who wrote the letter, even though they sometimes withhold the name, but they don't want anonymous letters. They have anonymous sources, but that goes through a reporter whom they think of as a reliable intermediary. So I should introduce that phrase, which I derived from earlier work of mine, that, you know, an interesting thing, anonymity to me means anonymity with no reliable intermediary. If Mark Twain writes a book and calls himself Mark Twain, but the publisher knows who he is, that's not anonymity in this world, it's pseudonymity, but it means that if he's done something wrong or evil or actionable through the publisher and legal rules, but even without legal rules, we can find Mark Twain easily and all that. Again, there are many ways on the internet where you can do without that. The bathroom wall, certainly you can do without that, except that we might hold the intermediary liable. There are cases requiring the owner of the property to erase the bathroom wall because it gives offense. So the cost to the entrepreneur of this social convention and not the legal rule, because he can always change the legal rule and say, oh, I don't allow anonymity on my website, but the cost to him is that then it's costly if law doesn't back him up because he's got to enforce this non-anonymity norm. One way to think about that is look at the sites that work so well. Facebook's got a lot of controls, but look at Amazon.com, look at CNET.com, especially look at Wikipedia, which is my favorite, and I spend more time on the paper than I will reveal here. These are elegant sites. I mean, they use combinations of box and labor. You know, try, I don't want to encourage it too much, and I don't want to confess experimentation, but hypothetically imagine that you experiment on one of those sites of putting in something juvenile. You know, CNET, you know, a new MP3 player comes out, and they evaluate electronics. And if you write something irrelevant on it, it goes away relatively soon, if you put in a comment. If you put something quite relevant on it, well, I have the Apple iPod, and I also bought this new Motorola MP3 player. The battery on this one lasts longer than the battery on that one. That comment's up there right away, it stays on forever. Even if you're anonymous, but if you put on, I got the Motorola thing, it sucks. That's gone in seconds. I mean, there's some bot going around looking for words like sucks and slut, and it gets rid of those words, you know, very, very quickly. I am told, and I've only experimented a little bit, that on most of these sites, Wikipedia is the most interesting with its 75,000 volunteer, you know, part-time editors, I hope. Many of you have joined me in editing Wikipedia. I spend more time on Wikipedia on the weekend if I want to fix something up, and that's what most people do. So if you put in misinformation, or if you call Amy a half-slut, so to speak, on Wikipedia, you know, something not so obvious but not nice, probably it'll last until the next weekend when thousands of people have had time to comb through, I mean, real humans have had time to comb through the sites. The point again in this, these are expensive processes. These are great sites. And if you like the internet, it's because you like sites like this. They're very, very hard to reproduce in another medium. But they're not taking advantage of the cheapness and the low-cost access and all that. They are on their own coming up with either an anonymity rule, or in Wikipedia case, a non-anonymity rule with a complicated registration process that can monitor you and get rid of you. We could talk about that more if you want. But on all these sites, it's either expensive or it's getting into anonymity, or usually in the best sites, some combination of it. I'm not so impressed with the... I want to say something about ripoff reports because it ties into this and Juicy Canvas. So if we think of Juicy Canvas as full of Amy X as a slut, and no, they promise you anonymity, I mean, it's the low-end site, right? Post here, anonymous gossip. We will never give away your IP address unless capital punishment threatens us. And, you know, advertisers can turn us down, tough luck. We'll just keep publishing these horrible things about people. It's fun. That's one kind of site. Ripoff Report says, if you've been wronged by, get justice, with a quote and exclamation mark. If you've been ripped off by a merchant, you should post a site, then I can search, you know, worst buy or something, you know, if I'm thinking of buying a thing at that retailer, and then I can go see all your complaints about worst buy. Well, you can picture the problem. There's noise, there's slurs, and then every once in a while, there are probably false slurs. Possibly people doing this against competitors, partly just people who like calling AMEX a slot might also like calling, you know, Bloomingdale's a slot or its commercial equivalent. Again, it's hard to know how to fix that in a way. I mean, the site potentially has a lot of use. The internet might be a good use for this kind of site. It's hard to know how to get rid of the junk and how to get rid of the noise unless you change an underlying legal rule, because anything creates a lot of effort for ripoffreports.com. For them to go investigate whether the claim is true or not, I mean, that would be back to old medium, and that would just require a lot of work. You know, one of the possibilities is that seems clever only at first, is that maybe they should be equal balanced, looking ahead to my hypothetical bargain. Maybe they should make it that the retailer is indifferent, because after all, you might also flatter them by saying how great they were when, on average, they're only mediocre. But you see the problem there, it's like Amazon.com in the old days. The merchant itself would then post lots and lots of positive noise about itself, and we don't really have a way of controlling that with anonymity. So the useful site, unless it requires registration like Angie's List and non-anonymity and even money on some of these sites, the useful sites, like Ripoff Reports, if you think it useful, really only has negative information, but then some of the negative information is bad, and you know, you can see the problem. Again, I'm not passing judgment on whether its social utility is greater than its cost, but we can see the issue. I'm not as worried about using non-anonymity or some other remedy that I'll get to get rid of the AMEX as a slut and gave me an STD host. At first blush, and some of the questions this morning or this afternoon got at that, at first blush that seems like a good mixture of possibly useful information with slurish information. And if you talk about it with law students, as I have, they're all, it's almost an automatic response to say, well, you know, this information could be useful. Where else are you going to find out whom to avoid? But of course, I'm not as impressed with that, because there are other ways to report sexually transmitted diseases. The paper goes into this a little bit more length. I mean, there are local health officials, there are university administrators. Now, you might not like what they do with the information. I mean, they have slightly different strategies. If you call the local health department and say, I got a sexually transmitted disease from Bill, their strategy generally is to say, you need to come in. I mean, they're not as interested in Bill as they are in you, partly because it's both awkward and problematic to go after Bill, and a lot of these reports might be false and all that. Whereas the other approach, the approach of the students who read UC Campus, if you will, is, since the reporter is anonymous, is only to know about Bill at that point, and then either to avoid Bill or to slur Bill. So there are different approaches, but I'm not as impressed with the social network site there, or the reporting site, because after all, that's the local health decision. I mean, they've decided that this is a good strategy. They could also decide on the Juicy Campus strategy, and they're not. That's true for many such things. With ripoff reports, there are other ways to complain about a bad business. So, at least for me, I'm not as impressed with that. The title of the paper assumes that I always love non-anonymity. That's not so, as you'll see in a moment. So I want to emphasize there are a lot of great things about anonymity. And as you'll see in a moment, I think there are hypothetical bargains where the group would agree on an anonymity norm. There's even a collective action that suggests that maybe we don't have enough anonymity. But the STD example doesn't really grab me. It's an example, and I offer the paper, but I don't think that's the best use of anonymity that we could find. Let me move to the hypothetical bargain, now that I've emphasized the noisy information problem, if you will. So, the easiest example is imagine a bunch of people. Imagine the people in this room, or 1,000 people in some community, and they're trying to decide, this is a contractual, non-constitutional approach to the problem, right? 1,000 people, and they're trying to decide what rules to have. Some of them might like taunting, maybe a small minority, really get pleasure calling somebody a thief or a slut. But I suspect that, or I'm guessing, that many, many more people, the gains to the taunter are pretty low compared to the harm to Bill or AMEX from being slurred. Moreover, AMEX doesn't know in advance. We don't know in advance who's going to be slurred. Therefore, in our usual hypothetical bargain, ex-ante way of looking things, if we all got together and had to agree in advance, would we like to be part of a community where we can slur one another anonymously? I feel fairly certain that if we put it to a vote or create a market with that satisfies or makes use of our intense or non-intense preferences, I feel pretty confident that we would go do something against slurs. It might be that we would get rid of an anonymity possibility. It might be that we would have a notice and respond rule. It might be that we would have a notice and takedown rule. I'm open to any of these remedies. It's the existing internet as outlier, easiest of those five media to do your stuff on, hardest to get stopped, no responsibility, no remedy, except in extreme or certain situations where your victim is lucky. That's the part that really bothers me. Just hard to believe that we would agree if we had power to make our own laws, if we were democratic, if we were market-oriented. Hard to believe we would agree to be part of a medium where our ANIX would be called a slut, just like that, or a bill would be called a slut or a thief, or what is it? The more you add in pieces to it, imagine some people who feel the opposite, imagine some people who get, even there's an occasional person who likes being slurred. They get pleasure out of it. It's fun to be the center of attention. Okay, maybe celebrities have such a hypothetical bargain. They have their own site called, you know, PerezHilton.com or National Enquirer. You know, they're welcome to it. But most of us don't want to, they can form their own community, and we allow those different rules. And I think law thinks something like the hypothetical bargain there, that the celebrities, the public figures, like the attention. But private people like Amy X, or semi-public figures like Brian, probably prefer the not being slurred, and I build on that a little bit. There's an easy collective action problem to see there, which is Amy X might pay them not to slur her, either ex ante or ex post, but she doesn't know who they are. They're anonymous. And besides, even if she could find out who they are, I'll pay you $50 not to slur me, and you would not slur me for just getting $2. Well, of course, then that's extortion invitation. People would then threaten to slur you in order to get the $50 from you. It's exactly like the tort rule we all start with first year of law school. You know, if I kick you, I pay. And then, you know, the smart student halfway through the semester says, oh, wait a minute, now I've learned the Coase theorem. We don't need a rule against kicking because you could pay me. The rule could be kick as you like, and then you'll pay me not to kick you. And then we realize, well, but that opens up lots and lots of threats and extortions and a lot of market failure possibilities. And that I think, is the, you know, the core of my argument there. It doesn't apply anywhere. You might imagine among employees at a firm, maybe there's a stronger notion there that it's very hard to speak about the boss. Maybe there are some communities that would agree to different norms. Maybe a labor union would agree to different norms. I mean, I can imagine some sub-communities, but the fact that there are some sub-communities that would imagine a different norm does not explain to me why the internet, alone among media, allows essentially everybody in these communities, all these communities and everybody in these communities, to get away with this in that way. I'm going to skip forward to make sure we have plenty of time for discussion. You know, if you do or don't like this hypothetical bargain idea, I'll do the don't like it. You know, one of your reactions to it is, well, what difference would they would all agree to? There are lots of things people would agree to that majorities would vote on or markets would go for that does not comport with law. I think fewer things than you think, I should say. If you think a lot of our constitutional rights, I think a hypothetical market would have the government constrained before it could wiretap me. People seem to like even though they don't know whether they'll be the wiretapped or the potential criminal, the potential victim of crime who might have slightly reduced crime if the government could wiretap. My sense is that there'd be an overwhelming majority, and certainly an overwhelming market, that would pay to have some sort of search and seizure rules, some sort of anti-wiretap rules, some sort of free speech rules. But there are some exceptions. You know, people would probably pay a lot of money to ban flag burning or something. I mean, I don't mean that every constitutional right we have would be reproduced in a hypothetical bargain. But that does require, for you to think that applies here, really I think does require a strong argument that something like a free speech claim is so strong that it should overcome this hypothetical bargain, and for what? I mean, that is, like as the discussion on Cesspool said, what exactly is the gain from having Juicy Campus out there? And it's not so hard to construct rules. We don't have to separate Juicy Campus from other norms. We don't have to come up with a subject matter rule or political speech rule or anything like that. Just something like, okay, I'll just make up a rule. We will leave in your immunity You'll be treated like you are in other areas of law. Internet will be no better, no worse than newspapers and television. And we'll give you immunity if you enforce non-anonymity or if you do your best to have a notice and takedown rule where notice and takedown is possible, unlike rip-off reports, I would say. Or maybe in some settings a notice response. I would expect to see a lot of experimentation in that direction. And that's my prediction in the paper. Again, especially in cases where the speech is not filtered through an intermediary. So a word about interest groups, and then I'll wind down. You know, normally, when I'll call this a social problem, right? The problem both of Amy X getting offended, hurt, and the problem of the entrepreneur who finds the cost rising because of all the noise and junk that's out there. Normally, when we have a social problem, there's a political reaction. So if gangs are new, I don't know if they are, but if the perception is that suddenly gang crime is a bad thing, you can be fairly sure that there'll be interest groups or politicians who will respond to it, maybe even overreact and say, oh, I can make political progress by standing up and saying, oh, this is a social problem and I have the following ways to defeat it, short of some constitutional, international, or other reactions. Indeed, I think you can make a pretty good claim that normally when there's a new social problem arises, there's probably political overreaction to it. You know, here we have a social problem, call it cyberbullying or juvenilism or noise on rip-off reports or what, false consumer complaints or whatever it is. I think here, there will be a political reaction, but there are also maybe even stronger interest groups that press for internet exceptionalism or whatever you want to call it. I think that's what we see in the marketplace for ideas, that there are people who see, oh, the internet's novelty and the internet's complete at the free speech end, or whatever we should call it, they see that as a cause. So it's very hard to predict where law will go. I think that those of us who like high-quality speech, even if we try to be neutral about it, which I think we do, I think we think that this is ironic because some regulation, just of the kind we find in newspapers, some regulation would probably get us more speech or more high-quality speech or less of the crappy wall with graffiti all over it, and hence the bathroom wall analogy. It might happen without law, I'm going to end with this kind of prediction. I think it will happen with a little bit of law, but it's from time to time there'll be political moves to treat the internet as we treat newspapers or as we treat bathroom walls or something to even out the playing field, if you will. But there will be dogged slurs and intermediaries like Juicy Campus. And it reminds me of sort of what it's like to be a porn shop owner these days. I think, there are porn shops, and they tend to be segregated in parts of cities, and then every once in a while, law rises up and comes up with some reason why there are too many of them, and they need to do this and be taxed that way, and they're offending children, and, law pushes and makes them smaller and smaller, and they fight back and get a little bit of legal protection or a little bit of a political reaction or something. But they sort of operate at the social periphery. And I think that that's what will happen to Juicy Campus sites once it settles down and we see them more as occupying a sort of more favored nation status than these other media. Because I think that most entrepreneurs, not wanting to be like the wall, most entrepreneurs will start requiring identification in order not to be noisy sites. They might even require credit cards. I mean, you might allow comments that you don't have to monitor so much if everybody on it was really identified. One way for them to really be identified is to know it's their real name. Maybe they've used their credit card numbers that can be traced or something. And you could establish some rules. If you want to post on my site, it's got to be this, it's got to be that, not this, not that. Just as I can have rules for coming into Bloomingdale's. And then all we'll need law to do is to enforce those contracts. And I think even big-time free speech advocates will be much more likely to think that that's acceptable for law to intervene only so far as to back up these private contracts. Well, we'll lose something with total non-anonymity on a majority of sites or notice and takedown or one of the other remedies we spoke of. We'll lose something. We'll also be flattered less. Right now you get free flattery on some of these sites. But we'll also discuss our anatomy less. They'll also criticize us less in ways that we might have benefited from. I don't mean this low cost. I just mean that the hypothetical bargain points us that way, and I think that's the way it will go. Thank you.
Thank you.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.